org. On Saturday, June 16th, there will be a walking tour in Troy, which highlights sites associated with the African-American community in the first half of the 19th century. The event is called Abolition and Escape, the Underground Railroad. It is hosted by the Rensselaer Historical Society.
I'm Paul Stewart. I'm one of the co-founders of the Underground Railroad History Project, and we're here in the Stephen and Harriet Myers residence.
I'm Mary Liz Stewart, co-founder with Paul Stewart of Underground Railroad History Project, an organization that grew out of a personal research project and has taken us on quite a journey, sitting in the Stephen and Harriet Myers residence, a building that was identified as a historic Underground Railroad site in 2003.
So can you talk a bit about this, how you ended up starting the project? You refer to a personal interest.
Back in the late 1990s, I was teaching in a fifth grade classroom, and I had some 10-year-old tangible thinkers who were quite convinced that Underground Railroad history had to do only with above-ground trains or subways. And in an effort to help these tangible thinkers get beyond that understanding, I decided to invite those students who were interested to join me in researching the community's history related to Underground Railroad activity after the school day had ended. And so throughout the school year, we conducted this investigation and found some very interesting things. But as you'll, you know, as is standard form, school years come to an end, and the students who were working with me moved on to sixth grade. And so I really wanted to keep the research going, but found that it made more sense to relocate that research to the city of Albany.
And I had been working for community service agencies in Albany, but on the side I was writing for community newspapers, and I had done some articles on Underground Railroad related individuals. So after Mary Liz kind of brought that project home, we thought we'd sit in the living room and read books about this sort of thing. The things that I think were of most interest to us were almost never covered in the material that we encountered. That is, things such as, who were the people who lived here in Albany, Schenectady, Troy, who were involved in the Underground Railroad, who were the people who came here on the Underground Railroad, and did they stay or go, and what kind of stories were connected with the people that were involved. Most of the time, these other sources that we were reading seemed quite satisfied to tell stories about Harriet Tubman and Frederick Douglass, but had no interest at all in really getting any deeper into the material in the ways that would have been of interest to us. So we decided to make it a project for ourselves, and we started. One of the interesting features of our journey of exploration was that a lot of times people would tell us things, and then we would discover things that contradicted what they told us. So that sort of spurred us on. You know, people would say, well, you can't find any information, and we would find things. A commission was announced that it would be formed here in Albany called a Freedom Trail Commission. And there are Freedom Trail Commissions in other places around the state where local governments would designate some people to explore the story of the Underground Railroad in their particular community or region. So there are several counties that have these. At that point, we had been exploring the story for a little while and kind of had identified a number of local stories that we thought were pretty interesting and that really should be the core of what anybody was talking about in terms of the Underground Railroad story in our area. And our expectation was that this commission probably wouldn't deal with the material that we were discovering. So we looked at how can we make this unavoidable so that people will have to deal with it. What we did initially was we created what we call a walking tour. And so we did some walking tours in Albany. We did some walking tours in Troy. And we would tell those stories about those people. So for instance, in downtown Albany, we walked down to Steuben and Broadway, where the Delavan House Hotel at one time stood. Edwin C. Delavan was an abolitionist. He lived in Ballston Spa, but he also lived in Albany. He had a hotel in Albany. He was a very well-to-do man, but he was assisting the others who were involved in the Underground Railroad. Stephen Myers, who was an African-American activist, at one time worked for an organization that Delavan sponsored, the Delavan Temperance Union. He had made his fortune as a wine seller, but then he became a temperance advocate. Temperance was kind of the way that a lot of people, there was pretty widespread recognition that alcohol, you know, it's like the water was not that good, so people would drink alcohol, but alcohol was like really kind of destroying people's lives when they would go overboard with it. And so temperance was regarded as the way to respond to that, to clean up your act, to make you a better person. So Delavan at Steuben and Broadway, that's one place that had some importance. At the Steuben and Pearl, Lydia and Abigail Mott at one time had a boarding house. And Lydia and Abigail Mott were a couple of women who were Quakers who were very industrious and kind of ran counter to much of the way 19th century women were expected to behave. And they were very much involved in the Underground Railroad. At the late 1840s, they had a men's furnishing store on Broadway. They would always have clothing ready to be made available to people who were traveling through town, people who were freedom seekers. And they were also involved in actually assisting freedom seekers who were concerned about being captured through the fugitive slave laws and helping them to get transportation to move on to freedom. So and there were other people like Stephen and Harriet Myers, an African American couple who really put a lot on the line in terms of their family, household, etc. From the early 1930s on until the Civil War, they were key people in this region in terms of assisting freedom seekers, people who had escaped from enslavement and were making their way to freedom. While we were working on the walking tours, one of our friends shared with us a flyer about the Vigilance Committee of the Underground Railroad. It said, and the flyer actually had an address on it. And since we were somewhat in the business of looking for where people worked or lived or conducted their activities, we had to go find that place. And we found it, and that's what led us here to this what ultimately was named the Stephen and Harriet Myers residence.
So can you kind of describe the power that is there in seeking out these stories, stories that have been lost or deliberately hidden, like, you know, or not sought after, or like what resonates there in the present from finding those?
For me, the strength of the stories comes from bringing forward the voices of people who have been silenced, who have, in my opinion, a right to be heard. And these voices for us in the Capital Region are in large part voices of African Americans who were dedicated throughout their lifetime to working for civil rights issues, many of which are still present with us today. The writing out of these people and their voices and their stories from history is the primary attraction for me and keeps drawing me in to continue the investigation. But at the same time, sharing of these stories and these coming from the voices of people who've been written out of history seems to be rather transformational for people who come particularly to the Stephen and Harriet Myers residence. But then also as we take this, we being Paul and I, as we take these stories out to the public, we have a little saying, you know, have equipment, we'll travel. So someone calls and says, can you come provide a presentation? We're on the road to do that. So for people coming to the Stephen and Harriet Myers residence and engaging with the voices of people who've been written out of history at the residence, and then also for those who in other public settings are provided an opportunity to engage with the voices of these folks, really does seem to be very transformative. And their retelling of their experiences is quite different than the standard canon related to Underground Railroad history, which, if we really take a look at it, really focuses primarily on two individuals, both of whom are Black, both of whom I tend to characterize as being made into superheroes. So for those of us who are local folks, superhero behaviors are not exactly what we can claim to be able to do as well as they did. And so what happens with the standard canon is that it becomes easily dismissible. Two individuals, two Black individuals, they're the only ones who really had any significant part in this history, so therefore it's a little blip on the stage of American history. And our claim, our contemporary claim, is that by bringing forward the voices of many other activists in the Underground Railroad, it becomes an Underground Railroad movement, a movement of civil disobedience, a movement that is not only part of American history, but really part of an international story. And so the relationship of Underground Railroad activism has had a much bigger part to play in developments.
For me, there's very much a process of discovery and surprise as we continue to delve into the story. And this has been something we've been working on for 20 years. It was 1998 when Mary Liz was engaged with her class around this project. It's 20 years of discovery, you know, and discovery in so many different ways. We certainly assembled a certain amount of information about the individuals that were, you know, that often make up the central themes. African American Dr. Thomas Elkins, African American activist Stephen and Harriet Myers, African American youth and then writer and activist William Henry Johnson. You know, these people, their stories have become richer and richer as we've continued to dwell with and work with this story. Thomas Elkins, as an example, we knew a certain amount about him, which was far more than what others were telling about him. Some people had seen the fact that he had a couple of patents that are on registered with the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office. And they often march that out when in Black History Month, people, you know, kids would be doing papers and they'd say, oh, Thomas Elkins, he wrote these two, he did these two things that he got and patented. But he was also an activist on the Underground Railroad. And it was our research really that brought that to public attention.
Something that I'd like to add to what Paul has said as well is that sort of a philosophical aspect to what we've done from the beginning is to engage in strategies that invite other people to participate with us, so that this is not our story, but rather this is a community story and rightfully belongs to the community.
What was it like? Could you paint a picture for us of what it was like to be an activist in the Underground Railroad at this time, like day to day?
Here in this space where we're doing the interview, which is the Stephen and Harriet Myers residence in Arbor Hill in Albany, there are kind of two dimensions to what it might have been like. One dimension is the fact that there are lots of things that Stephen and Harriet and their four children would have to do every day that have to do with leading an ordinary life. And then from time to time, there would be people at the front door who would be in transit, freedom seekers, people who were fleeing enslavement and who had been perhaps sent by Judge William Jay in Westchester County, or perhaps by Sidney Howard Gay, the editor of the National Anti-Slavery Standard in New York City, or one of the other, two or three groups in New York City that were also seeing fugitives from slavery. You know, they would want to provide a room for them, or they would want to arrange for a room for them in the neighborhood. So that there's both an extraordinariness and an ordinariness about what they had to engage in. There was the fugitive slave laws, which meant that anyone that had escaped from enslavement might be arrested and sent back. They would be brought before a U.S. commissioner. The commissioner would act as judge and jury. The person was not allowed to speak in their own name, so
I think it's worthwhile to add as well that both women and men who would culturally would be functioning in segregated groups, you know, men in one group, women in another. They were both groups, based on gender, were active in terms of other civil rights issues. So our Stephen and Harriet Myers, for instance, they weren't sitting around, you know, twiddling their thumbs waiting for the freedom seekers to show up at the door, but rather they were both engaged with groups of people who were like-minded, and so they would be working on various fundraising tasks, addressing or identifying and implementing strategies for addressing other civil rights issues, such as segregation in schools, voting rights, discrimination in housing and jobs, things of that sort. So it was a very multi-focused sense of for people in their daily lives.
Yeah.
Is it correct that at least Stephen Myers was involved with the Vigilance Committee?
Yeah, the Vigilance Committee was a group of people that came together, often compared to the Committees of Correspondence of the American Revolution. The focus for them was anti-slavery work, and so they would be both vigilant to guard the freedom of those who might be captured under the Fugitive Slave Law, vigilant to watch for freedom seekers, to enable them to move on to freedom, and also watching out for slave catchers to make sure that they could prevent them from obtaining their objectives. The Vigilance Committee was the group that really provided some support and accountability for the work that was going on, led by Stephen Myers and others who were active in helping freedom seekers. So the Vigilance Committee was, if there was a structure to the Underground Railroad, the Vigilance Committee would be a key part of that.
And it reminds me of the discord that also existed. Again, the traditional retelling of this history usually suggests that everybody's in the same place, everybody's in agreement, you know, the same goals are agreed to and worked on, and the reality was far different from that. We have certainly vigilance committees as one, essentially one strategy that certain individuals thought was a way to respond to the needs of freedom seekers and work at abolishing the institution of slavery. But there were also individuals who were quite dedicated to working through the political system, the result being the Liberty Party, Free Soil Party, Republican Party as strategies for abolishing the institution of slavery. Others believed that taking up arms was really the best and most appropriate response. And John Brown is the most well-known of the individuals who chose that strategy. But prior to him, we end up with Denmark Vesey, Gabriel Prosser, and others who were quite committed to this kind of assertive response to this institution. You have some people who believed that educating the public was the most important strategy, because there was a lot of apologetic effort on the part of pro-slavery forces to convince the masses and, you know, others and, you know, everybody, how important this institution of slavery really was and how essential it was. And so the education through newspapers, through magazines, through plays, other formats or venues, you know, became for some, lectures was another strategy as well that became very important to some individuals as a way to counter the pro-slavery posturing that was in existence. So there was also a whole collection of secular music that we have since called an abolition music as a genre, but it was a collection of music that was utilized by musicians of the period that would use melodies with which people were familiar, but the words would be changed. And these became, again, educational tools, rallying cries, and so on. So, for instance, a song like My Country, Tis of Thee becomes My Country, Tis of Thee, Dark Land of Slavery, For Thee I Weep, and goes on from there. So there's a number of songs of that type, too, that were also part and parcel.
I mean, I think I know the answer, but do you see what you do as activism?
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think it's in a way, I mean, it's an unusual kind of activism, unusual in the sense that although there are lots of other people doing other things, there are some things that we also need on the horizon. We need cultural institutions that are really wrestling with some of the core issues that have been dogging American society from the earliest times. And so in a setting like this, we can talk about race relations in a way that that many other museums might tend to shy away from. We can also talk about some of the political oppressions that are present in our society in a way that might be a bigger stretch for some other museum institutions.
Just being part and parcel of a community, we're not this historically focused organization, plunking ourselves in the middle of a community. Obviously, this is a very residential community and a residential immediate neighborhood in which the Myers residence is located. And so for us, we have, again, foundational principle for us as an organization is to make decisions that address needs that the organization has, and try to address them in a way that benefits the organization and the building and properties, but do that also in a way that is then in turn also of benefit to our neighbors. So we're not thinking about us, but we are members of a community, and so we need to make decisions based upon how benefits to the community at large. From the research we've done, knowing that particularly Black abolitionists saw the need to not only address the issues of abolishing the institution of slavery and assisting freedom seekers, but also dealing with responding constructively to other civil rights issues, housing, healthcare, jobs, etc. We see what we do organizationally in terms of trying to provide employment opportunities and so on as being related to the historic actions of these activists. So.
And also it's about developing a sustainable community institution that that reflects a history that relates to African Americans and others in the community. And there needs to be important history for African Americans as well, and that history is there. It just needs to be recognized. And in this case, we came upon the building at a time when the building was really in substantial disrepair, and we're able to give that building, because of its history and its story, a different narrative.
That was Paul and Mary Liz Stewart talking about the Underground Railroad History Project in Albany. To find out more about the event, Abolition and Escape, the Underground Railroad, you can visit their website for the Rensselaer Historical Society.